amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. If you'd like to start investing using the broker that we trust with our stocks and shares ISAs, there's a link down below to get you started. Use the code FTSE to get yourself a free share. My name's Steve W, and this week Tesla shares jumped 12% on news that the company plans to, wait for it, make some cars. Bristol Myers Squibb failed to announce plans to make any cars whatsoever, so its stock went down 9%. And shares in Lloyds Banking Group went absolutely nowhere as the company announced a 28% drop in earnings. Someone should tell that bank that there's better ways of avoiding a windfall tax. But we don't have time to talk about any of those things. There are much more interesting things going on. And to discuss them, I'm joined by Steve D. How are you, Steve? And how has your week been?
Getting some serious deja vu there, Steve. Feel like I've heard that opening before somewhere. Maybe the 80 or 85 other times we've tried to record this. But yeah, doing all right, Steve. Much better than I was on the other days that we've tried to record this when the market had kicked my bottom. I've had a rather good Friday. My portfolio, I mean, if we were talking about when we were trying to record it yesterday, I was down about 2.5% on the week. But now I'm up 1.28% on the week. So we've had an almighty turnaround. So I'm much happier than the solemn version that we will never hear because it'll never get released. Driving my returns this week is obviously Google, which has jumped 10% just on Friday alone, but not without some friends that have gone with it. Carver has jumped about 10%. Southern Copper has jumped about 5%. Enphase 3.83%. I think Amazon's gone 3.5% as well. And as I was saying yesterday, again, that you'll never hear, when Google and Amazon make a big move, my portfolio quite often makes a big move as well. And really, really pleased to see it, especially as I put about 1,800 quid into the market last night and some of this morning as well in various stocks. So I think I bought off the top of my head Enphase, Wise, Hortons, Accelis Technologies, and Prologis. So yeah, having a really good day with I think pretty much all of them. So Steve, how has your week been, and how's your week in stocks been?
Yeah, it's been a bit of an up and down week, to be honest. Yesterday was something of a low point, but feeling much better about life today, and the stock market's been broadly the same. As Steve kind of implied or hinted at, we had a go at recording this yesterday. We had several goes at recording this yesterday, but some big technical problems. I'm going to say on my end, but certainly coming to do with my recording. It's not entirely obvious, having tried a few different things, that it was mostly to do with my setup, because here we are on a pretty much the same thing and having a better result. But we had a tricky time last night trying to get this done. So it's now Friday, which is why Steve is talking about the great success of his portfolio this week. And mine's been pretty good as well. I was thinking yesterday I was going to be reporting some grim numbers, but actually even yesterday things weren't kind of as bad as they seemed. It started the week very strongly, so a bit of a step back actually meant I was sort of doing better than I realized. And when you're in the moment where things are going backwards, it can feel a bit rough. But I was looking yesterday and it's improved today, and Citigroup, which is sort of 16% of my stocks and shares ISA, which is the thing that I sort of describe. It's not where kind of all my money is, but it's where the most of it happens to be. That was up 1.5%, 6.4%, I think, on the week. Berkshire was up a couple of percent, and that's 10% of it. Realty Income was up 4.5%, and that's 12% of it. So lots of little things kind of ticking higher was making it quite hard for me to have a bad result, although I had plenty of things that were going the wrong way. I'm sort of looking forward to next week coming, when Amazon reports its earnings, will presumably announce a dividend, and the lid will come off that stock, at which point I will probably sell it if they decide they're turning themselves into a dividend stock. But we will talk more about Alphabet's earnings in a bit. It's been a kind of decent week markets wise, I think, and I'm sort of in a strange position of feeling like things have gone up, but still feeling like there are buying opportunities, which is the opposite to how I'm normally feeling. Stuff goes down, and I still sort of think it looks overpriced. Steve, what do you make of things?
Yeah, for me, it's been the stuff I don't want to buy that's really shot back up. I think there's still quite a few decent opportunities in the market. I mean, I wouldn't have put 1,800 quid to work if that wasn't the case. So, yeah, there's plenty of places that I was, really happy to put my money last night and this morning. And long may that continue. Although, to be honest with you, Steve, I am totally out of cash now. That leaves me with about 100 quid in my account to go on. So I need a big premium bonds win to just a million or something. That'll be all right to be able to pump some more cash into the market at the moment. It's been one of those weeks where things have got more and more expensive as things have gone out of it. I don't know if we've spoke about it on the show, but we're having the patio done because it's basically an ice rink in the winter, and having old parents and a young family, it's probably not the safest way to get into my house. So we're having that done, and we decided that was our one big job to do for the year. And then we're having we've ended up having the bathroom done as well, because the baby turns out that she really, really loves a bath, and we don't have one. We just have a shower. So we're having a bath installed. The plumber turned up on Monday, and I went to go lead him to the bathroom and found my wife explaining that we need a new kitchen sink to him as well. So, Steve, it's going to be a very expensive year at this rate, but I will endeavour to keep pumping money into the market, especially when there are opportunities like they are today. How about you, Steve? Have you got your eye on anything in particular?
Payday's coming, isn't it? I've mostly got my eye on that, to be honest. Owing to a kind of slightly confused effort as to how I shifted stuff over into the ISA versus the GIA, I suppose, or Investors Trading 212, put it. I've actually got myself over-invested at the moment. So I've left myself shorter of cash outside the investment portfolios than I meant to. That will sort itself out when payday comes around. So I'm okay with that. But I think, and I've also completed my end of year's tax thing earlier this month, because that's something that needs doing every year. I did it shortly after April 6th. I often do it kind of first day of the new financial year, but I was on holiday at that point, so I can be bothered. I came back and did it, and that's told me how much I need to put aside for tax. So job number two after this will be whacking that somewhere where it can earn some interest for till January or so, and then take that out and get that paid off as well. So I feel like I've got a few kind of things to work around here that's going to mean this is a lower depositing month for me, where I try and put back some of the things that in some cases I've accidentally deposited, and in other cases I basically found out that I owe as the liabilities side of things goes. So there's plenty I kind of got an eye on at the moment. A lot of stuff I've talked about before, and a couple that I'm sort of working up to present when we get out of earnings season and 13F season, which is also on the way. In the meantime, though, I've been consuming things, and it's interesting that you kind of mention the different ways of thinking about portfolios. I've been listening to a 2019 interview. It's an episode of Invest Like the Best, which is a podcast from, I think, sort of broadly the same family as Business Breakdowns. But it's not a Business Breakdowns. It's focused on kind of more investors and styles and different approaches that people take. Anyway, this is with a guy called Chris Bloomstrand, who has done Business Breakdowns. He is probably the most, the source of the most detail when it comes to Berkshire Hathaway. But he wasn't, he was talking about that for part of this podcast, but that's not the bit I was zooming in on for the purposes of this. He runs a hedge fund called Semper Augustus. Largest holding in that is Berkshire. But he very much is a guy who thinks about investing in terms of long-term compounding. So he's looking for high returns on invested capital and the ability to keep investing the cash they generate at high returns on invested capital, rather than running out of opportunities and therefore dividending things out. But he's an ROIC guy rather than, say, a revenue growth guy. So kind of the same mindset as Berkshire, but he was talking about the Semper Augustus portfolio, and he was saying, in a way that's got me perhaps questioning the way I set out to start this year, that as of 2019, they own stuff in their portfolio that they didn't anticipate owning for 20 years or whatever. He said, look, at this point in time, back in 2019, may still be true now for all I know. He was saying, look, I can't find 25, which is the number he looks for, good compounders at prices I want to buy them at. So when I can't do that, I fill them with lower quality stuff that's underpriced and wait for the market to sort of correct this a little bit. And I was thinking about that in terms of my own portfolio, because I've made reasonably clear in various places the companies that I think are the best. And in a lot of cases, I trade at prices that I don't think I can kind of go to. So an example that immediately comes to mind, because I've been thinking about it a lot lately, is Diploma, which is a very good acquirer, a very good compounder, very high returns on invested capital, keeps growing, keeps finding opportunities to move things higher. Trades at close to 40 times earnings, which to me indicates it's going to take a fair bit to consider that good value at this stage. So I suspect a better chance will come with that stock. I don't know when and I don't know how, but in the meantime, I look through my portfolio and I think I have certainly a few companies that I don't think are as good as Diploma in there, but I am buying them or have been buying them at sort of decent valuations. And listening to Bloomstrand kind of reminds me that it's okay to sit on some of those positions for a while, where you think, well, either this thing will correct or it will pay me a massive dividend for ages, or potentially both. But if it does correct, so I think, Steve, you sort of own Pfizer with a view to this kind of idea. That price is too low, and one of two things happens. Either is the business is going to keep making the cash it makes. I don't think that's going anywhere for the foreseeable. So either they pay you a load of that in dividends and buy back a massive amount of their stock, or the share price goes up. And if the share price goes up and the dividend yield goes from whatever it is, 6% to 2.5% or 3% or something, well, then you can sell it for more and stick it somewhere else. But in the worst case scenario, that's a decent enough use for your cash in the meantime. I thought it was a really interesting interview, and it kind of reminded me that while I am working hard to not churn my portfolio for the sake of it, selling some of the things once they've corrected because I bought them because I thought they were undervalued and stick by the thought that they were undervalued isn't necessarily the worst thing in the world. So yeah, interesting podcast to have a listen to. 2019 episode of Invest Like the Best with Chris Bloomstrand. I'd listen to pretty much anything that he says. It nearly all comes back to Berkshire in the end, but it's not just the same bunch of here's how Berkshire works stuff in episode after episode. So yeah, enjoyed that one.
You may remember Bloomstrand from he used to do during the Tesla run-up when Tesla went to over $1 trillion, however high it went, he used to do 3,000 and 4,000 word essays on why Tesla was overvalued and why people were overvaluing the insurance arm. He unfortunately chose to deliver that message via Twitter in 380 thread messages of why, very in depth as to why Tesla's insurance is not as straightforward as Tesla saying, we launch an insurer, we win all insurance, unlimited demand at the end. It was very interesting times that period in the market, and he was trying to bring some rationality to it, but by delivering his messaging quite angrily typed Twitter threads. But interesting fella, and yeah, definitely worth a listen. So my consumption for the week is something a little bit different. I didn't actually have anything until today, so I was going to put a video of Future Islands, which I shared with a friend of the show, Anathema, on Discord, of a very eccentric frontman of a band, just because I had nothing else. But I've chosen to talk to you a little bit about finchat.io, and just to straight off the bat, we're not sponsored by FinChat. I know a lot of podcasts and sort of people in this space are. We're not. We're actually just recommending it because it's really, really good. At the moment, there's a free version out, which you can sign up to without your credit card details, anything like that. I think you get a 14-day free trial of the pro version included in that. But even when that ends up, when that ends, you'll still get 25 free prompts a month. So you can test out the FinChat AI. And I'm here to tell you it's actually really, really good. We have used it today to summarize. This is one of the things it's really, really good for, is just to pop in there, summarize Alphabet's most recent earnings call, and it will bring you up not very much, you know, maybe 3 or 4 bullet points from each segment of the call and the key moments in the call, and it will just list them out for you to read really quickly and get yourself really quickly up to speed. But it covers and it covers and separates them into things like financial performance, company milestones, and then things like guidance and parts of the analyst call as well. And then it'll go down and start feeding in all the revenue data and all the analyst data for you. So it's just like one big long scroll to get you up to date really, really fast. And like I say, you can do that 25 times a month in the free section. So I'm going to pop a link in the description. And if you sign up via that link, you'll get all the benefits of Pro that we can get. And we get a month for free if you do that. So and I'll share this account with Steve so we can have a run through it as well. But I highly recommend you check it out with our link or without it. I think it'll save you a lot of time, and I think you'll find it really, really helpful. Steve, have you used it?
Nope. First person signing up to that is going to be me, as someone who spends quite a bit of time working through these things and trying to write them up for Motley Fool, mostly off my own back and initiative and so on. But I, summarizing these things would be very helpful. This is the kind of AI the area where I think AI has some really obvious disruptive potential. The people I sort of talk to in my day job, as it were, so teaching at a university, seem less worried by this kind of thing. They think, and I don't think this is just them being macho or grandstanding, they think they've got skills that this isn't replacing yet. What I think this is replacing is the stuff that I do, which is trawling through data to find stuff pretty well, which is the lower ended stuff. And then I offer my own kind of thoughts on it, but I'm not as well trained in this as I am in philosophy, which is kind of my day job stuff. And I don't rate this when it comes to those things. I've got to the conclusion that this is decent at nearly everything and great at nearly nothing. But look, if you're looking for decent and you're looking for fast, you may well get a very interesting take out of these kind of things. So I will definitely be having a go at this thing. Sometimes, though, I feel like there just aren't enough hours in the day for me to go and buy stocks, Steve. I regret the fact that the buy button doesn't work at 2 a.m. Do you think there could be a solution to this in the future?
Potentially, yes. So so Steve is hinting that the New York Stock Exchange has just been looking for opinions today from sort of market participants about shifting the US stock market to a 24/7 operating schedule. So rather than having your 9 till 5, or for us it's 2 till, is it 2 till? Half 8 or 2 till 9? I can't remember the actual hours are of the US market.
It's till 9. It sort of depends on where the clocks are at any given moment. But at the moment, it's 2 till 9.
So basically, this has all come about because they've seen during the crypto sort of COVID-19 crypto pandemic, when it really sort of picked up and retail investor interest has blew up, and also that the that level of volume has not gone back to, you know, following standard sort of trading timelines. So the stock market or the New York Stock Exchange is thinking perhaps that, you know, they could replicate some of that success. And it's not something that I want, Steve. I certainly won't be in a rush to use it. My worry is that it thins out liquidity during the day. Just people become night buyers and we end up with, you know, thinner liquidity and bigger spreads during all points. I don't really see how it benefits anyone at all, really. Steve Cohen he's trying to launch a trading platform called 24 Exchange, and he wants to be a full 24/7 exchange as well at the moment. So I think this is maybe the New York Stock Exchange just jumping a little bit before they were pushed. But I don't really want it, Steve. It's not something I'd be interested in. I'd be interested to hear what everybody wants at home. But Steve, is this something that you're in a mad rush for?
No, I do not like this at all. I think this is the opposite direction of travel to where things should be going. Both you and I, Steve, of course, are well-known cricket enthusiasts, cricket being one of the kind of main sports, at least that I can think of anyway, that has scheduled meal breaks built into it. And that's obviously something that I would naturally approve of. The Shenzhen Exchange, I was just checking over in China, that has a built-in lunch break. So the market's closed for half an hour so people can go off and eat. And presumably no one can get their positions like evaporated during that time. That's the direction I would rather see the New York Stock Exchange go in. We need a built-in kind of lunch break for people who, it wouldn't stop people like us trading during our lunch break. It would probably stop people like us trading on the commute home or something like that, depending on when it would exactly fall, I guess, or when directly you kind of get out of the office. So the more I think about this, the more to your point about thinning liquidity, that's a much more serious one than mine. But I've always taken the view with extended hours trading or anything else of that nature, that if I can't find enough opportunities to invest well enough during standard opportunities, I don't think stretching out it's not the hours in the day that are making me or anybody else a terrible investor. It's our ability to spot opportunities and so on. And I'm not convinced that having the New York Stock Exchange open 24 hours a day and thereby eliminating the time difference makes any real difference to anything from my perspective.
Yeah, I'd be interested in the comment sections and what have you, if this is something you're really interested in. You let us know, but as far as I'm concerned at the moment, this just looks like a net negative to everybody, to be honest. I think most people would sooner less hours, you know, more condensed trading times, and Buffett always said that he wouldn't even care if it wasn't open for a year at a time. So interesting, Steve. Anything on that before we shuffle on?
Just one thought is that, I mean, we've seen this a kind of wave of companies in various different ways preferring New York to London as their stock exchange of choice. I'm not sure this is particularly widening the NYSE's moat particularly, but it's the kind of forward-looking move that London isn't coming up with any time in the foreseeable, as far as I can tell. And so, I mean, I sort of feel like they're far enough ahead without kind of worrying about making their product more competitive. But I'd be surprised. I don't know whether I'd be surprised to see London going the same way. I sort of hope not, because I don't really see how companies in general stand to benefit from this in the way that they do benefit from a bit more kind of attention that the New York exchanges get.
I had a very brief Twitter chat with Bloomberg journalist John Stepek about this on X, and he said that at this rate, the idea of basically a single universal equity market that's just located in the US, caters to everybody, and private equity for anything that's like more local, is looking like an increasingly plausible outcome. You add the fact that they'll be open 24/7 to that, and you've got a recipe there for everything to be in America and everybody to be happy about it, I guess, Steve. What are you, any thoughts on that?
Maybe. I feel like this is one of the few areas where I think Cathie Wood might be right in thinking that the NASDAQ, which was kind of once edgy and disruptive and so on, is now largely full of incumbent entrenched things. It's not, Amazon's not an up-and-comer anymore. It's a big deal. And if you're thinking about what the kind of largest and most significant companies are with established positions that are dominant and leading rather than disruptive and upcoming, actually the NASDAQ is full of these things. And it's probably about as heavily full of these things as something like as the S&P is. So I can sort of see that there wouldn't be any rate much loss by running the sort of two exchanges together here. It's not massively clear to me. I've seen some lists on the NASDAQ and some on the NYSE. There's probably stuff to do with fees around this that I haven't looked into properly. But I think consolidation here wouldn't be a bad thing. I mean, they're separate companies that own these, right? So it's ICE that owns the NYSE, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and something else that I've forgotten, and NASDAQ that owns the NASDAQ. So I'd be interested to see how that would work in practice. But I'm fine with that idea in principle. But good name dropping.
Thank you. Steve, Have you been looking at any stocks this week?
Yes, let's talk stocks. So Meta Platforms, despite their decision to pay a dividend from a quarter ago, the stock is down 15%, presumably because they, or fell 15% after their earnings, presumably because they didn't announce a good enough dividend increase. They're now on that space. So anyway, they, on the face of it, their kind of numbers were pretty decent from the first quarter. Revenues were $36.5 billion, which was 27% up, and their operating margin was 38%, which was up from 25%. And when revenues go up and margins go up, then earnings go up as well. Earnings per share in this case were $4.71, which was up 114%. In general, this was a pretty good report, unless you're a big fan of the metaverse. That thing continues to lose money, and it managed to burn away another $3.8 billion in Q1. I asked you at the time, Steve, whether if they spun this thing out, you'd put it in the capital incinerator pie. But this is properly incinerating capital here, right? It's kind of interesting to see what comes of that. This is... I get the need to invest in stuff if you're a big tech company like this, but the metaverse is a really interesting money hole to my mind at the moment. But the family of apps did much better. They managed to increase their kind of top line revenues by 7.7 billion and their earnings by 6.5 billion. And when things are going like that, investors are much more content to just wear the losses from the metaverse. It doesn't feel like so very long ago that we were saying, metaverse, massive sinkhole, got to cut it, got to stop it, got to shutter it, got to spin it, got to do something with it. And Facebook was trading at 11 times earnings. Nowadays, things look much brighter. They're turning around better. They've had their year of efficiency, margins higher, revenues higher, profits higher. Everything looks great. And somehow, their number of users on their platforms is also up by 7%. I kind of thought they might be running out of people in the world sooner or later, which tells you either they have a lot of fake accounts, which is possible, I guess, or they are still growing, you know, pretty impressively here. So with all that in mind, it's not just the metaverse. The question that obviously occurs to the likes of me is, why is this stock down 15%, or why did it go down 15% after that report? And the answer is guidance. So Q1 put up some very impressive numbers due to two things. One is higher revenues or rapid revenue growth, and the other is wider margins, and putting those together gets you much better earnings. For Q2, the company kind of guided the wrong way for the market's perspective on both of those things. So their revenues came in, or guidance came in at between 36.5 and 39 billion, which is between 14 and 22% growth year over year. And that's slightly lower than what the market was hoping for. Analysts were expecting 20, so 14 to 22 it's in that range, but it's maybe midpoint slightly lower than that. They also said they're expecting higher CapEx as they keep building out their kind of AI stuff. So you're looking at costs to go up, and you're looking at revenues growth to slow, albeit still comfortably double digit in this. So maybe between 10 and 20. 14 to 22 is what they said. Share price is up 42% on the year, and that sort of small pullback reminds people that if you zoom this back out to be a sort of four-ish month chart year to date, it actually looks like a very small drop down from where they were. Price earnings ratio is around 24. I guess the really interesting question, in my view, is exactly what will be these AI investments will turn out to be. If it turns out it's the next family of apps, this company's cheap. If it turns out it's the next Reality Labs, this company's probably a bit more expensive than I would like to buy it at here. I can see a genuine case for AI. We've been talking about it earlier on this show, if you're listening to the long version, but I can see that there's genuine importance to AI. I can see it matters to Meta to keep their kind of position here. If it turns into another kind of Reality Labs money hole, I am increasingly dubious about Reality Labs and the metaverse. I've never been a big fan of the metaverse stuff, but at least they didn't like name their company after it or something and get stuck on that idea. Steve, what did you think of any of this?
Going back to Meta's Reality Labs, Steve, they are about one quarter away from a new milestone. Do you know what that milestone would be?
Is it losing 50 billion?
It is losing 50 billion, yeah.
I think they're at 45 billion or so, right, at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, so, and bear in mind, this product was only launched in Q4 of 2020. So we've gone from Q4 of 2020 to Q1 of 2024, and we're about a quarter away from losing the big $50 billion. And it's kind of taxing to look down that, even just last year, and see like there was the $4 billion, 3.75, 3.75, 4.65 billion just last year, and then 3.85 again. Now, they're huge losses. That might not be recouped for 20, 30 years at the way that the Reality Labs is growing. But that aside, Steve, this is a fine report. So we're talking about 3.24 billion on average daily active people. That's an increase of about 7%, which you don't often get. Ad impressions were up 20% year on year. Average price per ad was up 6% per year. So when you add those three together, they're your triple whammy when you're an advertiser. So that'll only naturally lead to pretty large revenue increases, which were about 27% year on year. And then you've got a company that was obviously still in the efficiency sort of phase, total costs and expenses was only 6%. So if your revenue is up 27 and your costs are only up 6%, you get a lot more money flowing to the bottom line. And that's exactly what you see here. So at the moment, just looking at Facebook's balance sheet, they've got $58.12 billion in cash, and they're looking at more share repurchases and obviously dividend payments as well. In the last quarter, they repurchased about $14.5 billion worth of shares and paid out $1.27 billion in dividends, all while still reducing headcount as well. Steve, headcount down 10% year on year. So this is a fine report for screwing down profitability. I think you're seeing all of the big guns, and I'm including Microsoft, Facebook. Anybody involved in AI at the moment is paying their levy to Nvidia to build up their AI and server capabilities. And Facebook is going to be no different to that in the next quarter. So, there's nothing wrong with this report, Steve. For it to fall 15% on this report, I think is incredibly short-sighted. It's not really fallen enough though to be a buying opportunity. I would have read this report and I would have told you this is a mighty fine report. There's nothing to worry about here. And if you was telling me to guess, I would have said Facebook was probably level, maybe up 2 or 3% on the back of this report. So to see it down 15 is a shock to me. But like you, Steve, I've never been a buyer of Meta. I've never bought it. And I don't think this is the sort of move that's going to make me buy it. You have been a buyer of Meta then, so is this not where you want to be either?
I have been a buyer. I bought Meta when it was a much lower earnings multiple than 24-ish or wherever I had it pegged earlier this week. I bought it when it was closer to 13. To be honest, I sold it much, much sooner than I ought to have done here. I think I sort of take your buying point as my starting point when I think about how justified this is. I think, do I want to buy it at these prices? No. And that makes a sort of 15% drop to me seem... I mean, there's what's justified given where we were before and what's justified kind of full stop. So in terms of, do I think the number that Facebook is trading or Meta is trading at is now too high? Yeah, I still do. And therefore, I think it was too high before when it was 15% higher. Like you, I didn't see this report as the catalyst to move it down 15%. I mean, I didn't think it should have got up to where it was before. But it's had a strong Q1. To an extent, that's been... We'll come back to this when we talk about Google and Alphabet in a second, but it's done much better than Alphabet has, and it's corrected its way back towards them quite significantly as a result from the start of the year. So I think one of the things I guess I keep my eye on for Meta is that they really stand to benefit from a TikTok ban, don't they, in the US? They're not an obvious kind of instrument of US soft power, but they are a potential beneficiary of a kind of standoff. We've talked... Whenever we talk about NVIDIA, we talk about China and US exports and sanctions and restrictions and so on. One of the companies that stands to potentially benefit if things stay kind of slightly tetchy, and I think they might actually for a little bit, is Meta with its social media stuff if TikTok gets eliminated here. If you hadn't burnt $50 billion, by the way, they could have probably bought Palantir or something of a similar size. So I guess that's worth thinking about. Would you rather have spent $15 billion on a metaverse, Steve, or would you rather have Palantir at this juncture?
I don't think they would be allowed to buy Palantir. I don't
think
Meta are gonna,
I don't think they're
never
going to
win a government
Palantir
contract. Yeah.
Maybe they could buy something else. Maybe they could buy... there are other things of a similar size they could buy, include National Grid. They could buy that. And if they like dividends, they could just use that to pay all their dividends. But anyway, decent report from Meta, I thought. Shall we move ourselves forward?
Yeah, let's move on to Alphabet. So, and again, this is another really, really strong report. This one is, I want to say the return of advertising, I guess, the return to strength of advertising, because if you looked at Snapchat's report as well, that was also pretty strong and showed some pretty big jumps in advertising. So this is maybe, the beginning of a bit of a cyclical tailwind, perhaps. But I'll just quickly rattle through these for you, Steve. So so Alphabet's revenue was $80.5 billion. That was up 15%. Non-GAAP EBIT was $26.2 billion. That was up 31%. It's about a 33% margin. So it would have been higher, but there were severance charges. In terms of net income, Steve, that comes to $23.7 billion. That was a jump of 57%. It's a margin of about 29%. And op cash flow of $28.8 billion, free cash flow of about $16.8 billion, which was actually a slight drop of 2% due to pretty high capex, to be honest. So the EBIT obviously includes about $2.2 billion in equity gains as well from their venture capital arm. So in terms of segments, so Google Services revenue was up 14%, ad revenue was up 13%, search revenue was up 14%, YouTube revenue was up 21%, Google Network was down 1%, subscriptions was up 18%, Google Cloud up 28%, Steve, so quickening the pace of growth there, which makes Amazon's report quite exciting. And other bets, Steve, brought in $500 million in revenue, up 72%. Pretty interesting to see other bets bringing in a bit of money, because I always look at that segment with the sort of disdain that I look at Reality Labs. So interesting to see it doing not too bad. They said that Google Cloud brought in about $900 million of EBIT, which is up about 371%, which is about a 9% margin. And other bets, Steve, then took all of that away with about minus $1 billion in EBIT, which is a margin of minus 206%. In terms of geographies, US revenue was $38.7 billion, up 18%. Europe, Middle East, and Africa revenue was 23.6%, up 13%. Asia Pacific revenue, $13.3 billion, up 14%. And other Americas was $4.7 billion, up 14%. So I think I was reading Michael Mabusin's latest paper, and he was talking about how using people using the PE and comparing historic PEs to new PEs are missing the fact that these giant companies at the top of the S&P 500 are spending about double the capex that the oil and energy giants do every year on maintaining their position, that potentially missing a trick by using their earnings lines as a way of valuing them, which is something that we've said, Steve, for a really long time, because when you can spend, multiple billions on capex every year and still generate massive profits on the bottom line, that makes you almost impossible to compete with, because some private equity guy has got to foot the bill for multiple billions, to try and get people on side, and private equity is just not about that risk, Steve. I was just an incredible report, really, from Google, back to double digit growth that came faster than I expected it to come. Not much to not like in here, Steve. Anything jumping out at you?
Just before I get onto what's jumping out at me, you didn't think Meta looked like a 15% down report. Did you think Alphabet looked like a 10% up report?
They're similar reports, aren't they, I thought. I think... So I don't know, because I think one of the things that we probably both realise as young parents is that you get a lot less time to look at stuff. So sometimes you have to remind yourself as well what actually, you know, what happened, rather than, you know, like what brand of milk your daughter likes the most. And in my head, I've got that Google's been the slowest of the Magnificent Six, because we don't include Tesla in it. And I think that's been one of the worst performers out of the lot. So for Google to jump up in my head, and this is just in my head, makes sense to me. And for Meta to fall back, you know, makes sense to me, if we're thinking about an expectations kind of thing. But that might all be rubbish, Steve. I'm sure you're more clued up on it than me.
I had a little look, and year to date, after Meta's drop and Alphabet's kind of rally, Meta is up 28%, Alphabet up 25%. So your thought that they are similar reports largely kind of rings true here, right? The share prices have kind of pulled themselves together a little bit, Meta from above and Google from below, effectively. But yeah, I was interested in that because I also thought they seemed kind of similar. I actually thought they were both quite impressive. But the kind of result is that one that was dragging has come up a fair bit, and one that was perhaps accelerating away a bit quicker than it ought to have, but not doing badly by any means, has just checked back a bit. So wind back sort of 3 months or so, and the reason that Alphabet's been I guess kind of faltering a bit, it's only kind of, or trailing some of the other magnificent, however many we think of here, was largely because it looked like their ad sales growth was slowing. They posted a disappointing report in January, at least from the perspective of analysts, and it's one of these things, kind of the Reality Labs-ish thing. So Reality Labs looks terrible when everything else is going badly, and Alphabet's kind of textbook weak point, I guess, is its dependence on its ad sales. That is pretty much all the business. It's still 77% of the of total revenues. Even with the cloud growing rapidly, it's trying to make its way up to something. And you can feel one of two ways about that, right? You can think, and we've talked about this on the show too, either I got a lot hanging on this advertising sales thing. This had better work and better not get disrupted by a lousy AI launch or ChatGPT or whatever else. And at different times it does and doesn't look like it will. Or you can think, okay, great, 77% of revenues here are really, really high quality. Why would I want to dilute that down with stuff from other places? And it feels like when things are going well, people feel the second way, and when they're going badly, they feel the first way. And a decent kind of report from ad sales in particular, back to sort of 13% growth in that, indicates that it is why people suddenly feel all right about that. Actually, you know, three quarters plus of your business is doing really, really well in this situation, which is why that's kind of been, I think, why it was dragging before and why it's pushed its way back higher for the time being, and dragging your portfolio higher with it as well. I say that's why it's pushed it higher. I mean, we know the real reason is that there's a 20 cent per share dividend been announced, which amounts to a dividend yield at today's prices of 0.44%. Fortunately for people who like shareholder returns, there is also a buyback of $70 billion on the way, which amounts to, I tried to work this out by subbing back out stock-based comp roughly. So I think what you get from that is sort of 2.5% reduction. So add that to your dividend and you're looking at kind of 3 in distributions, which is, it's all right for a company the size and growth ambitions of Google. If you can distribute out 3% of your market cap whilst also maintaining overall double-digit growth rates on the top line, that's quite impressive. Comes back to your thought here, Steve, of being able to kind of redeploy capital at fairly high rates, and therefore your earnings looking a bit less, looking a bit lighter than they in fact are. Lastly, where you said, look, if you have that ability, private equity is not going to be able to compete. I kind of agree. I think the way I think of it is it's yours to lose. I'm mindful of Intel, which had a much bigger R&D budget than everybody else, but they did manage to find a way to lose that lead that they had in chip design to AMD. I don't see that happening with the culture that runs through Google and Amazon, Microsoft, to be honest, any of these big tech companies. We don't talk about Microsoft that much on this show because neither of us owns it and both of us think it's really expensive, I think. And it just keeps getting better. And if we looked at where it was when we started saying it was too expensive, I suspect we would feel differently now. But it's a very impressive business. And all of these big tech things, I don't see any of them making a mistake of complacency. If something else comes and beats them up, like antitrust or whatever, that's a different game. But I don't see them doing the Intel thing, getting complacent, making a bunch of bad decisions, and getting overtaken by some smaller, at the moment, competitor with less of an R&D budget.
Microsoft's probably on our Mount Rushmore of stupid takes, I would say, Steve. It sits there with Visa and probably Intuitive Surgical. When we're talking 4 or 5 years ago, me and you was talking about buying those, and just being slightly away from where we wanted to be. And I guess Nvidia, if we were to have four, Steve, they'd probably be the four that we quite obviously looked at and said that these are extremely good companies, and at various times trading only little bits above where, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 PE above where we wanted them to be when you normalized earnings. So yeah. But just quickly, Steve, then. So they were keen to point out on the call that YouTube and Google Cloud were other bets at one point, and they're due to exit 2024 with a combined over $100 billion run rate. So they have been pretty incredible. On YouTube, they focused a little bit on and said that there's now over a billion hours of YouTube being watched on TVs daily, and that YouTube subscriptions are now over 100 million. That includes music, though, so that might be screwing the figures just a little bit. So they said that they're going to use the AI tools in ad creation. They think that this is going to help advertisers target better. They said that they're going to use it to sort of judge ad strength for people with the people that they're targeting. And they found that when they tested this with people, that they're 63% more likely to publish a campaign that Gemini, which is Google's AI, tells them is either good or excellent in terms of ad strength. So they were quite keen to point this out. But they said there's really six areas in which that they thought that they were the leaders in the next wave of sort of AI innovation. And they basically said it's research leadership, infrastructure leadership, innovation, and search, global product footprint, velocity and execution, and monetization. So they're really confident, Steve. You can see why they're so confident at the moment. I think the improvement in revenue and earnings and sentiment has given CEO Sundar Pichai a bit more of a sort of like bounce in his step. I've seen a lot more of him recently. There was a period when Google was slowing down and was getting battered that he sounded a little bit like potentially he was thinking he was on his way out, maybe that potentially his seat was getting just a little bit hotter. I'm not saying that he was on the chopping block, but there was a lot of people out there saying that he was, you know, not doing a very good job and this, that, and the other, which you always get at times when a company is slowed down. But just recently I've been listening to him talk again and he seems sort of reinvigorated. So I think that's always a good thing. And yeah, for me, fantastic. Couldn't really fault it. And it's the reason why it's the second biggest company in my portfolio. Steve, do you want to shuffle on, or have you got anything to finish that segment with?
Two final thoughts on that. I'm surprised at that number of YouTube hours that you mentioned. I thought, mostly because I thought the number might be higher, actually. My little one left to his own devices appears to watch a couple of billion hours of YouTube by himself. So I'm surprised the kind of total number isn't higher than that. Regarding Pichai, things are looking much brighter for him at the moment. I mean, Alphabet has had a couple of operational blunders in rolling out its AI stuff, and I think that had turned the heat in a fair bit on him, rightly or wrongly. But yeah, it's nice to see things kind of looking brighter on that one. Let's move ourselves onwards, shall we? More tech.
Okie doke. So I've been looking at Adyen this week, which is It's had a bit of a dodgy week. I'm just going to check now because I was going to say it's down 15%, but I noticed it was up 2% today. So on the week, it's down 16%. So it must have had an even worse week. So yeah, it had a really dodgy Wednesday, was it? Was it Wednesday it fell so much? I think it was, yeah. And it was all because of this report, Steve, which we'll shoot through and we'll see what people think of it by the end of it. So this was a business update. So being a foreign company, Adyen doesn't really have to give the kind of level of information that American companies do. They only have to do it in halves. So normally like second quarters a lot better, and obviously fourth quarter's a lot better, and then they kind of just do these like little statements just saying this is where we are in the first and third quarter. So it's shorter, but there's enough information in there. So process volume for Adyen was 298 million euro. That must be billion. 298 billion euros. That must be a dodgy note from me. Shall I check that quickly?
No, yeah, you do that. I was writing about Google this morning and a copy editor sent something back to me. Effectively, she was pointing out that I'd left a billion off the company's total revenues and said, this appears to be quite significantly understated where you said they've made about $84 in revenue during this quarter. So it's quite easily done, these kind of dodgy note things.
Yeah, that was a dodgy note. So it is 298 billion, up 46% anyway. So big growth in process volume. Yeah, digital process volumes grew by 51%. Unified commerce volumes grew 30%. Platform processed volume was up 55%. If you ignore, if you exclude eBay, in platform process volume was up 116%. Net revenue was 438 million euros, up 21%. 80% of that was from existing customers just growing volume with Adyen, less than 1% volume churn, which is perfect for a payments provider. Take rate for the quarter was 14.7 basis points. That was actually down from 17.7 basis points this time last year. So this is what we've explained before with Adyen. It's the company's playbook of accepting lower pricing to generate a higher total payment volume. And just so people know, because take rate is one of those things that's never in releases. It's just revenue divided by process volume. So it's really handy for payment companies when you use it in context. In terms of headcount, the 22 full-time employees quarter on quarter, Steve. So they're showing a sort of relatively sort of stable headcount there. So we should see that, you know, the capex levels start to stabilize in terms of headcount. Long-term goals, they said, was completely unchanged. Net revenue growth, they think, will be low to high 20s through to 2026. They think the EBITDA margins will be over 50% by 2026 using their operating leverage. And they think CapEx will remain about 5% of net revenue. They did a little Q&A afterwards, Steve. It only took 30 minutes. And all these answers were from CFO Ethan Tandowski. And I am relying quite heavily on Dutch investors on Twitter. Somebody I'll link in the description because I missed it. And they did a very good summary for me. So on the growth in Q2, they said it'll be at the low end of their expectations. So you're going to expect about low 20s% revenue growth. So they talked about whether they had lower take rates, and they said that there's no structural changing in their pricing. They are a premium company. You pay a premium price, and then the more volume you bring to it, the cheaper and cheaper it gets. They said that teams within Adyen focus on net revenues and not on take rates. So they focus on bringing volume to the platform and not on just maximizing, you know, not getting 1,000 small businesses in and taking the highest take rate possible. They said that they offer a premium services and people pay the price for it. One of the things they brought in was Cash App. So they've got Cash App volumes coming through this in this last sort of 12-month period. They said that the volumes are about the same as Q4 2023 and they've not had any major impact on Adyen. Volumes can be lower than net revenues depending on which project we focus on what time. That was quite an interesting little statement, that one. It took me a while to get my head around that. But they said that there's more and more local payments being introduced into the market, which makes the payment market a bit more complex. Complexity is a net positive for Adyen because they're very good at handling complex payment infrastructure. They said that they're able to grow with all with the largest digital US businesses. They've added a lot of wallet share this year, as you can see by the total payment volume growth. They think they're growing pretty well over there. And the share of wallet gains in volumes is the sort of biggest typical driver of their growth. And at the same time, the more volumes they do with a customer, the lower their pricing goes, which is why we're seeing that sort of drop in take rate. What we're seeing is monster companies bringing more and more of their payment platform onto our gen, more of their payment volume. And thus, you know, it looks like they're having a slip in take rate. It's not a slip in take rate because of competition and ad gen dropping their prices. It's just that that volume is up so much. So for this to fall 16% in a week, Steve, feels pretty stupid to me. I think this is pretty much right on the money from where I would like to buy some more. If I can shuffle some money into the market, I will. This is probably where it goes next.
Okay, so I saw you on Twitter, as I insist on calling it, saying the market still doesn't get Adyen's take rate. I mean, the point you're making there is it's as straightforward as saying, look, the take rate's down 16%, and the result of dropping the take rate by 16% is 80% volume growth. So you're better off by staking a lower take rate because you get like a ridiculous amount more volume coming through your system like that, right? That makes a load of sense to me. This shows up in loads of other industries for what it's worth. The one that kind of most obviously jumps out at me is actually the kind of railroads industry. People complain about Berkshire and why BNSF never does this thing called precision scheduled railroading. Precision scheduled railroading leads to higher margins. It also irritates all your customers. It might be different if you have a kind of railroad because there isn't another competitor around, but there is in the case of these things. So in essence, Berkshire goes with lower margins to keep its customers happy and keep more and more higher revenues coming through their system. That's exactly the same move that's being made here by Adyen, albeit in a sort of a more competitive environment because they're not the only kind of game in town. They're not protected by regulation in quite the same way. I was sort of reasonably impressed by this. They guided slightly low then in that case. And we saw in the case of Meta that stocks that have had a good run and guide slightly low, they do fall away. But I mean, Adyen had a fall away not terribly long ago, and then it had a big jump again, and then it had another fall away kind of again, which puts it, well, everything I was reading about this, I skimmed over a few headlines from variable sources I wouldn't necessarily stand behind. But everything I was reading this analyst side said, your basic bottom line here is the right one. This is short-sighted. Get ready and keep an eye on the next couple of earnings calls here. And that's not really our kind of game of expect this thing to snap back in 3, 6, 9 months or whatever. Our game is much more, this thing looks cheap compared to its likely future cash as a result of its product, market position, ability to attract new business, so on and so forth. But in general, I think there's a quite a, I mean, not in terms of the market there isn't, because the thing keeps going down for the moment. But from what I saw, there was plenty of agreement with you on this, that the stock didn't ought to have gone as low as it ought to, as it has after that set of earnings.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I just don't think there's many companies out there that are talking about $298 billion in process volume, Steve, that they've grown 46% year over year. I just don't think that's a thing. So for Adyen to be growing process volume at that kind of speed, it is somewhat of a network effect as well, because the more successful that Adyen gets, the more people it's gonna move to the platform, and you can see this is evidently happening, that people are shifting more and more of their payments onto Adyen, and quite quickly the flywheel will push this to Adyen's bottom line, because they're pretty light on capex. They're pretty good at turning EBITDA into free cash flow. I think it's over the 90% sort of line. So at the moment, Adyen's trading at a PE of about 50, Steve, which, you know, if you run a general screener, this isn't going to be coming up for a value investor. But I'm here to tell you that I think this is very, very good value here, providing Adyen can continue to grow, even at 30% rates on process volume, which is lower than we're getting today.
I said the wrong number a moment ago. I said 80% volume growth. What you said to me was net revenues were 438, and 80% of that was kind of growth from existing clients was where the 80% thing came from. I was scribbling quite quickly and I wrote something down, which is accurate, but it misled me. I've written 80% is volume growth, not volume growth of 80%. The reason I kind of pick that up is because it kind of implies to me that customers stick around then as well. I mean, you mentioned a network effect as a source of a moat. It implies that either there are switching costs built in or that Adyen just has a better kind of product than its competitors. And if you think that's either of those things is true, then combining that with a network effect makes quite a powerful kind of competitive position here. One thing we've always kind of associated with Adyen, especially over the last probably 6 months or so in my case, is being kind of counter-cyclical when it comes to hiring. So what have we seen more recently with interest rates going up? Everyone in big tech is busy firing employees, good employees, bad employees, people who didn't ought to be employees in the first place. But we're not in zero interest rate times anymore, which means it's not just as straightforward as saying, yeah, you can have a job, send an email and go away. And Adyen had held off its recruiting and didn't over-recruit in that kind of zero interest thing. And they are, I think we said maybe 6 months ago, they were looking to kind of build out their staff base and their expertise and so on. I think I was reading that they've done that slightly slower than they expected to. They're still kind of looking to recruit, looking to bring people in and looking to kind of build that. I viewed that sort of positively in terms of if your plan is to be cautious and get it right when you do it, it's good to see you kind of being cautious rather than throwing everything at the first kind of wave of redundancies here. If you think the other fintechs are either in trouble or overstaffed, there's going to be, or even the banks, to be honest, might have useful employees for you here. There could be interesting people to come further down the pike. So I think I read that their kind of recruitment was sort of ongoing in terms of the, I guess, the catch up, if you like.
Yeah, it's a measured approach to getting the right people in, isn't it? So it's one of the things they did do there when the salaries were getting too competitive and people were, you know, getting offers way above you know, what the original you know, the asking price was on the job application, and Adyen just stopped recruiting. And they're acting counter-cyclically in that regard. But yeah, it was interesting to see that they're slowing down. Perhaps, Steve, they've just filled their pockets with the employees that they needed at this point. Perhaps they're just waiting for you know, the right sales staff. I suppose it's kind of like if you sit there with a loaded gun and then you shoot it all off a little bit early, you know, with more redundancies to come, maybe you don't quite get the best people. So yeah, I think a bit of patience here is maybe the best strategy. Adyen blatantly doesn't need more staff at the moment. They seem to be running away with it.
Yep, impressive stuff. And look forward to hearing your update in 2 and a bit months or so as to whether you managed to get anything. Pick up any more shares in this one, I guess. One last one then. Unilever, UK company, finally got round to reporting earnings this week. It's sort of earnings. It's a trading update, so it doesn't have no numbers in it. It's got some numbers, but it is mostly, I guess you'd call it, a sales update. And this is a company where I thought this was pretty good, all things considered, considering where they are. So since the start of the year, Unilever has reorganized itself into kind of 5 operating divisions, and its basic plan is to cut away some of its more staid stuff and focus in behind some of its stronger offerings. They exactly what their strongest 30 power brands, as they call them, are, is kind of unintuitive to me. But I suppose this bunch of results indicates that they have the right idea and I don't. So their stock was up 5%. Earlier this week after their latest update. And the reason for that is their sales were up 4.4%. And that's the result of a pretty even split between higher prices and higher volumes, which make of what you like here. In the consumer product space with Unilever and branded goods, they are eminently trade downable from, I think. They will tell you that, you know, brand power works here. And to an extent, this proves them right, but it's not like products are sticky here. There's not a subscription that you have to try and get out of. If you bought whatever Hellmann's mayonnaise last week. You can absolutely go and buy Hines this time, and it will not make the blindest bit of difference to you in terms of a cost of switching. So it is pretty aggressive stuff here, and there's a danger this collapses into commodities. But in fairness to them, pusher prices higher, volumes still go higher across the board. That actually indicates that there's something other than a commodity going on here, at least as far as I can tell. Their best division was their beauty division, which was up sort of 7.4%, which is actually quite meaningful top-line growth for this kind of operation. It was mostly volumes, 5% and a bit volumes, and just under 2% price increases. And the worst bit was the ice cream division, which was 2.5% up, and their volumes were down. They pushed the prices by 3% and sold 1%, basically less, in terms of stuff. To some extent, that indicates that they've got their strategy bang on. Their plan is to spin, realistically spin, they think, but if they could find a buyer for it, I'm sure they would be willing to sell it for the right price, the ice cream division, by the end of 2025. We talked about this before a little bit as to the whys and wherefores when I was suggesting that I thought this looked quite interesting from a buying perspective here. The reason being ice cream, well, clearly volumes aren't growing and it's also more expensive, has lower margins because you need a frozen supply chain. If you already had one of those, then that might be some justification for that, but Unilever doesn't. It only has it to push ice creams around. And it's not obvious you can improve that division either because as ice cream brands go, Unilever's are some of the best with Ben & Jerry's and Wool's and Magnum and Breyers and Halo Top. But more good news. So, I sort of view that as slightly mixed news. I mean, it's a sign their strategy is the right one. You're trying to dump the ice cream business because you don't think it's that good. That said, you haven't dumped it yet, and it would be nice to get a decent price for it if you can. And getting a decent price for it involves having it not look like a complete dog once you've spun it out. It's one where I think, like the Kellogg cereal separation thing, I'm going to keep a close eye on that because I made a bad error on the Kellogg cereal thing. I should have bought the spun business when it absolutely cratered out the gate and was offering something like an 8.5% dividend yield. At that rate, the thing doesn't really need to grow very much. But we will see what happens with Unilever's ice cream outfit going forwards. Interestingly, margins were also wider, and there's a 1.5 billion euro, there we go again, buyback on the way, in addition to what is already a sort of sensible-ish dividend. I didn't net that out. I'm not sure it does much more than offset stock-based comp, but it is at least there in terms of a kind of capital return. To my mind, this didn't change an awful lot, mostly because I thought the stock was in a decent position before. I think this company has the right strategy. I like the idea of selling out some of their weaker bits rather than trying to grow by acquiring yet more stuff, focusing on what generates a better return for them, which apparently is stuff like Dove and Vaseline and Tresemme. The bit about the strategy I was dubious on is, okay, I get you should dump some of your weaker things here, but can you get more out of your kind of stronger brands? Well, according to this, yes, you can. 7.5% growth in their beauty division is not something I'm in a position to argue with. Sales-wise, that's very good for this type of business. My estimate of what this thing is worth hasn't really moved because interest rates haven't really moved. And this shows me that the strategy is working, albeit slightly better than I thought. But I'm still thinking my fair value estimate here or area I'd like to buy this thing at is probably close to 37. It's now around 40. So I've sort of taken my eye off this one for a little bit. That said, I've said on both this show and JKR's show a little while ago that I thought this could do reasonably well. Steve, were you impressed by this thing that I, at some point in the past, you've thought about owning, but not that recently?
I feel like I have owned this at one point, but not for a very long time. I think it was somewhere I parked my cash for a period of time because I felt it was just an incredibly steady kind of business that was I was not going to do an awful lot. And I seem to remember it not doing an awful lot either. And I ended up pretty much just losing the stamp duty on it. Two things jumping out at me though, Steve, is what they're calling a productivity program, which for people at home who are not aware means they're sacking 7,500 people, and that should bring in looks like about 800 million euros in cost savings, but will cost about 1.2% of turnover for 2024 through 2026. likely in restructuring severance. But yeah, the ice cream separation is jumping out to me as something that is interesting, Steve. They're looking now, whereas last quarter, I seem to think they were sort of thinking about selling it, Steve, is what I was, the vibe I was getting from them. But now they're saying it might make a lot more sense to demerge it. And they think that is the most likely separation route. They think they're going to create two simple and more focused companies with distinct operating models. And they reckon that this will be done, Steve, by the end of next year as well. So interesting to see that. I wonder if that is going to be the catalyst now for somebody to come in and pick that up, make them an offer and say, look, save all this money on figuring out how to demerge it. We'll just take all those off your hands for, you know, maybe a couple of hundred million less than it's worth. But yeah, it's a pretty fine report, this, Steve. I mean, you're going through all the various segments and seeing little bits of growth here and there, which is what you expect from a company of this size. It's very hard for them to churn out big double-digit growth, but to see, you know, mid to high single-digit growth is exactly what you need from Unilever if that's what you're going to park your money in. You're basically going to say, you know, we need you to return about 5 or 6% in capital appreciation with the buyback and pay me about 3 or 4% dividend. And that's your capital return. That's your total return for the business. So they look like they're probably on track to offer that. It's what's it trading at in terms of earnings? Because it used to trade at quite a premium. When I first started thinking about investing in individual companies, I always remember Unilever was that it was a British company that traded at, you know, one of our big companies that traded at a bit of a premium. But recently I've seen it's been more in the sort of 15 to 16 sort of earnings range. Is that where it still is?
No. Now it's stopped looking like a UK stock. So there was a time where it appeared to have that kind of UK discount that you might think. If you think someone like Unilever is pretty much of a muchness with some of the US staples companies, it's now close to 19, which is... as I say, it's kind of 10% higher than I was sort of looking for. I was very close earlier before this report, actually. I didn't realize the report was due. But I was very close before to sort of trading out all my Kraft Heinz shares for Unilever ones, because the reason I own Kraft Heinz is because I thought it had a fairly clear path to being better, which basically came in the form of debt reduction. And they were clearly working on that. And I didn't see a similar thing with Unilever, which I essentially saw going absolutely nowhere. And Kraft Heinz came with a bigger dividend yield. Well, it reached a point that once you knock off the withholding tax, you get to the point where Kraft Heinz's dividend is lower. And I think Unilever does have some reasonably good prospects for going higher looking ahead. But as you point out, this is about as good as I think you can expect from this type of business. And that's not really a knock on it. It's just a case that you can't sell much more stuff like this by going crazy with pricing, which means I want a higher starting return for that. So I was thinking interest rates are around 5% and a bit, but I think they'll come down. Unilever's dividend is going to go up, I think. So start me at 4 and we can see if we can unlock a bit more using this restructuring strategy, which seemed about right. Unfortunately, this stock has now pushed higher and the yield's down to about 3.5%, which I think is too low to start off with. Not massively thinking of it as a passive income stock particularly, but I am thinking about the overall return and where that's coming from.
Yeah, I agree with you there, Steve. I think it's... I'm just looking at the ice cream part now thinking, I'm not sure I'd want it. If they were spinning it out, I think it's fine as part of a larger sort of portfolio, but you can totally see why they're looking at this thinking it's a bit of a drag. There's not an awful lot of growth in it, and even in their highlights, you know, the highlights of some of the parts is really interesting things that they've done, and the highlight is in the ice cream section is we launched a new variant of Magnum. And you're like, I don't know if that should really be in the trading statement. Do you know what I mean? They're talking about like fabric cleaning having great volume growth, had a negative price in emerging markets, but home and hygiene grew mid-single digits and Cif and Domestos were really strong. And you get to ice cream, it's like, we made a new flavor.
Everybody hated it. We pushed the price up and the volumes went down.
I think somebody will buy this and somebody could make a go of it. Somebody who's actually focused on and interested in this is coming. I think that perhaps is the issue that Unilever has lost interest in it. And I think part of that is Ben and Jerry's just going against absolutely everything they want to do, which is fine because they acquired Ben and Jerry's and literally told them they could do that if they wanted to. When you give people, that kind of slack, they tend to run with it. So, yeah, fair play to Ben and Jerry's for being able to negotiate the contract, and fair play for them to, standing up against whatever. I suppose if you're going to have company values, then it would be strange to disregard them the minute it came to any trouble. So think of that what you will. I think that's probably the reason they're going, though.
Yeah, may well be. But it's nice to be talking about stocks that we're positive on for pretty much a whole episode this time, actually. We talked about sort of Meta and Alphabet and Adyen and Unilever, and we do and don't own various different ones of these. But I think that was four pretty decent reports for the companies concerned. Things appear to be generally going reasonably well for all of them. That was nice, wasn't it? So join us next week on the Playing Footsie show when we will be talking about presumably some abject disasters that are coming out over the next 7 days. Wait and see what they are. We'll see if we can find them for you. But thank you for joining us. In the meantime, do check out downstairs our link to Trading 212 if you haven't signed up with them already. Worth remembering that you can have more than one stocks and shares ISA as a UK investor. You still only have a 20,000 limit, so don't go blowing over the top of that. But if you've already set your ISA up somewhere else, you can still join Trading 212, use our link and get yourself a free share, or just sit all your cash in it and claim some interest. But for now, from me and Steve, we'll see you next week.